Okay, so, a love story. All right, I'm in Kyoto. I'm at this party, and there's this woman. She's tall for a Japanese lady, 5'10", 5'11". She's got everything working. The boots, the hair, flawless complexion, the smile. I have to say something to her. The Detroit in me would never forgive myself if I don't step up. So I roll up. Sumimasen, nante no namae wa nan desho ka? Start talking to her, and she acts like she can't understand my Japanese. I'm like, whoa. I'm not front like I'm just a tremendous linguist or anything, but you can understand what I'm saying. She looks at me and smiles. So this girl. Fair enough, she says. But I just don't understand why anyone would travel halfway around the world to use the same tired lines as everyone else. Snap! Dial! Hora. All right, good point. But you just stand right there. I'm going to say something interesting now. Stand. And I don't know what I started blathering about, but she says, let's go for a walk. And in a very non-Japanese way, she asked me what's happening back at my house. I don't know. Let's go find out. We get back to my crib, and this is the part NPR told me to cut out of the story, right? Let's just say it was guns blazing. Pa-pow! The next morning, I'm like, no way. This is how it happens with me now? This woman's way out of my league, but she's super nice, crazy, intelligent, model, pretty. What gives? I look over at her. She turns to me, puts her hand on my cheek, and says, Green-san, I have a boyfriend. Oh. And I knew it had to be something. It wasn't like I had a boyfriend. It's like I have a boyfriend. Well, shoot, that's a shame. But it's been really great getting to know you. And he's in the mafia? The Yakuza? Right. Right, okay, but what's that got to do with— And I have to tell him about what just happened with you and me tonight. What? Tell the Yakuza, hey, it's me and you thing. Nobody has to know. I have to tell him, and he's going to want to talk to you.
No. Dame kora. Y'all keep your crazy games to yourself. She starts getting dressed. Thanks for a wonderful evening. Don't do it. She opens the front door.
Sayonara, arigato gansan.
She hails a taxi and she's gone. And it's not 1 hour later that my phone rings. This primal scream, these threats. And the guy, he finally breathes and tells me that I can either come see him or he's gonna come see me. And I can't have the mafia coming to my house. I can't. I tell him I'm gonna come see him. 11 o'clock that night, of course. He manages a nightclub. What else would a gangster do? Of course. I'm gonna meet him at the club and face my certain doom. And all day long, I sit there. No food, no drink. Just me thinking how not to get killed. He gave me two choices. I had to pick a choice here or there. He can't come here, so I gotta go there. But when I go there, he's gonna have his boys ready and I'm gonna die. The clock is ticking away. And I decide, you know what? He says 11. So I flip the script and knock on the door of the gangster club at 7 p.m. Someone opens up. I see some minions sitting down at a card table. I'm about to ask for their leader. And this dude, he kind of strolls from behind a curtain-off doorway. Tailored dark suit, manicured hands. Shirt collar open because he doesn't wear ties. He's got two underlings on the left, two more on the right. Cool, brother. I look at him. He looks at me. And the cool explodes into another primal rage, crazy screaming fit.
Nadia! Nadia! Nadia!
He runs towards me and he's shouting and crying in front of his boys. I don't know what he's saying. And I'm trying to tell him how sorry I am. I didn't know. It's a crap situation and he deserves better.
Nothing! Nothing going on! Nothing!
Why? Why did she tell you why? And then he leans on my shoulder and sobs. Big, racking shudders of grief. And I comfort him, even as he tells me he has to kill me.
No.
See, killing me won't solve anything. She's setting you up and you deserve better.
We have to at least give you a beating.
But that's what she wants you to do. Isn't that what she's counting on? We, you and I, are not gonna give her the show she's looking for. Look at me! It ends today. Alright? Alright?
So this, and we bro hug it out.
And I'm on the way back down the stairs when I hear him say my home address into his phone, and I almost my pants before I realize he's not calling his boys on. He's calling them off. Now, Glenn, that's all well and good, but why did you tell me this story? Okay, well, let me assure you, there are more people who have almost been killed by gangsters for love than there are Prince Charming stories. Believe me, but you'd never know. The man doesn't want you to know. He wants you to believe that your relationship history is the problem. It's not. So today, from PRX and NPR, we're calling this episode No Perfect Love. My name is Glenn, the Truth Doctor Washington. Set your online dating profile to back in a minute because you're listening to Snap Judgment. Snap Judgment. We're going to kick off today's Snap Judgment with a story from Carrie and a guy we're calling Jordan. A story that answers the question of the ages, is love enough? Snap Judgment.
When I met Carrie, Carrie was 19 and I was 22. And I didn't know who Carrie was and therefore wasn't interested in knowing who she was. I did notice she had a micro tape recorder with her.
I was recording people laughing or choking. I saw him talking to somebody that I knew, and I just butted in and asked,
"Do you want to fight?"
Fight.
Fight.
Everybody was like, "What? This guy is slapping this woman. Is this okay?" And they saw her, you know, cracking up. So they left us alone. I think that was the moment I started developing a crush on Carrie. I did love Carrie. How hard she would hit. She wasn't afraid to hit me painfully hard, which isn't something I enjoy in and of itself, but her lack of fear was so attractive. Attractive. I have Asperger's. It makes it very hard to know how to talk to women that I like.
Well, I knew that he had a crush on me. He made it very clear. And I thought it was just sort of like a crush that we could both get over and then continue being friends. I just wanted to hang out with him.
I guess it was a year later. We decided to start this band.
We can make marmalade from the spoiled fruit from the trees that grow from the bad seeds.
Thinking about bad seeds. Do you have anything
I don't
else
even know what kind of music to call Rafflecopter. It's yelling.
Carrie is a terrible singer, and I'm a pretty bad guitarist.
Get it?
Got it.
Good.
How many strings did you just
play? Two.
And nobody came to our shows. So we were probably talking on the phone, and we always talked about Rafflecopter. Like,
Rafflecopter should play a show where we do da-da-da-da-da-da.
And I had just said I've always wanted to play in a church, and he said,
let's just get married.
And I didn't even think about it. I just said,
yeah.
Obviously.
It was always all about the show. What I wanted and what she was on board for is for none of our friends to have any idea that this was not real.
I told all my friends I was getting married, and anybody who questioned me about it, I just shut down and said, yep, I'm getting married. It's on Sunday, you can come or not. We did get a real wedding certificate, but in Massachusetts, after the pastor fills it out, you have 60 days that it is active, and if they don't get it in the courthouse after that time, it's not real.
I called this church, and they said, okay, so when do you want to get married? And I said,
I'm leaving on tour. I want to make sure our wedding is before I leave for tour.
She said,
and what does your fiance do?
She's a bike courier.
Oh, that's a very dangerous job.
And I said,
yeah, I worry all the time.
As if I was actually her fiance.
So in order to get married, we need a church. Got it. We need a marriage certificate. Got it. We need to tell our friends. Told them. And all we needed was a pastor.
I called this guy, Alex, and said, hey, will you pretend to be a priest for our wedding? And he was like, yeah, I guess I can do that.
And before I knew it, it was my wedding day.
She spent a long time getting dressed. Like, she would change clothes and come back, and I think she was enjoying the fact that I was kind of checking her out, because she looked very beautiful that day.
Jordan took this really beautiful picture of me while I was playing his guitar, and I had never seen a good picture of myself until then. And I was like, oh my god, I look so beautiful on my wedding day!
And then we walked to our wedding. Then gradually the guests filed in.
Alex, the fake pastor, started his pastor speech. Jordan said his vows first. So I was expecting him to say something like, dear Carrie, your bike is broken, you're evicted, I love you, that's why, the end, bye.
So I started with, everyone thinks this is a joke, but soon they'll see how serious it really is.
I'll always love playing shows, but being married to you is my new favorite thing. I'll always try to be the man you need me to be, as you have always been the woman I need. And I will love you in sickness and health, good times and bad, across any distance and forever.
I was thinking, I cannot believe how much my vows suck. Can I not read them? What should I say instead? Maybe I should just read what I got. Maybe I could say something really nice back too. Or, I don't know.
After I said those vows, Carrie said,
dear Jordan, the first time I met you, I knew that your name was Jordan. You're so dumb. I hope you're sterile. People made their awkward, like, very generous laugh. And then the pastor is just like, okay.
I now pronounce you man and wife. You may kiss the bride.
Are they gonna kiss?
Now, obviously, I would have loved it if I could have even considered actually kissing Carrie at that moment.
But then Jordan whips out a kiss mask.
It was a printout of a Gene Simmons mask, actually. So I put that on her and people laughed.
finally, the ceremony ends and we get to play music in a church. That's why we came there. Jordan started playing this song, which I had heard before, but never really listened to. So I wasn't prepared for him to start snapping. And I got really hot because I was nervous and I was thinking about my dress and my pit stains, like, ugh.
As I stand alone in my shower, I look through the curtain to the mirror and see.
This song is really beautiful and is coming from his heart, and I'm just standing there bearing witness to it. And everybody's just looking at us. And it's just not funny anymore. And I'm just like, oh my God, this wedding is real now. It wasn't supposed to be real. I'm feeling the things that people usually thought out before their wedding. Like, why am I here? I thought this was just a joke.
And I kind of wish you would come to see me.
I think that might have been the first time she noticed something that I always felt around her.
In the song, he's almost like giving me the space to say no. He's saying, I kinda wish you would call and see me instead of staying at home and riding your bike. Like, it's not like, come to me, I love you, or like, I am gonna come get you, I'm gonna win you, you're gonna love me. He's just sort of like far away, like a few miles where he is, just saying like, I have this love for you, it's here, if you want it, I just love you.
We kept playing the set, and we closed with Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles. And then at the very end, after the last titular line, Carrie yelled out, no!
Our friends started filing out, and
we tied soda cans to our back, like just dragging them behind us. So then we walked to the convenience store for our honeymoon.
Outside Tedeschi's, I had the conversation with him where I had to say, we're just friends, right? I think we're just better off as friends. We're not really married. I felt let down at myself. The only thing that stood in the way of this day going perfect was the fact that I wasn't in love with him.
And I didn't see Carrie again until 59 days after our wedding. And we didn't really talk. But we knew, okay, this thing expires, so we need to have an annulment show.
Yeah, the pastor was there.
Alex.
Which I was not expecting.
We did our whole set. It was the same set as the wedding. But at the end, we were playing Holy Shit, We're Really Married. And Carrie said, I hate this song. And I said, yeah, well, I hate this marriage. And then I tore up the marriage license. Everyone applauded, and Carrie said, it's over. He's single now. Any takers? I called her a couple months later and asked,
how are you doing and what's happening with your love life?
And she said, yeah, I'm seeing someone.
No, that's great.
She said that she was now dating Alex.
Alex.
The priest, who she had met at our wedding, and that she had lost her virginity to him. Not only do I not get what I want in this person I love so very much, but the person I want to have her the least is the one who gets her, and it's my fault that it happened. And that was how I spent Valentine's Day 2008. Feeling really terrible alone in my apartment about it.
I guess I loved Alex. And then he cheated on me so hard. Even the who don't give a damn, they don't deserve it, but they always win. And he did, he won!
Why are they so much luckier than I am?
He was luckier. God, it's like you predicted it. And then eventually the pastor waned away. Forever. Jordan's still there. And we talk all the time. Every time I hang up the phone, he says, I'll love you forever. Forever. Forever.
see? Isn't that great?
Don't worry too much about Jordan, guys. He'll be spending his Valentine's Day with his long-term girlfriend.
And as such, he wants to remain anonymous. Carrie's a writer here in Oakland. We'll have a link to her website at snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Anna Adlerstein with a sound design by Davey Kim. And when Snap Judgment returns, a love like no other. And how do you extract revenge on a person that loves you more than any other? The answers when Snap Judgment, the No Perfect Love episode continues. Stay tuned.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the No Perfect Love episode. Today, we're pushing all the nonsense out of the way and digging into the heart of the relationship. Now, you might like your relationships at the gym, some like it on the mountaintops. Our next storyteller, Tim, he's a guy that knows to take his life wherever he finds it. Snap Judgment.
I was born in Scarborough, Maine. Specifically, I was born in the grandstand at Scarborough Downs as a racetrack. My dad was a jockey, and my grandfather was a trainer. And so I started at the racetrack at a real early age. Horse has been my whole life. The racetrack's a pretty rough place. It's a hard life, you know? I broke my tailbone. I broke my neck. Actually, I'm crippled right now from horses. I love horses. I like being outdoors. I don't believe I could work in a building. Like this building I'm in right now, I could deal with it, being inside. I'm an outdoors person, always have been. Well, the first time I met Lisa was I ran over her, believe it or not, with a horse. I was on a runaway horse. Well, the horse, he would break off with you and just take off at a dead run. And I hollered up ahead to Lisa. I didn't even know her name was Lisa at the time. She fell to the wall, her horse got loose, and my horse ran out of the barn up and across the street and ran up into another barn. I went back across the street to make sure Lisa was all right, because the horse did knock her down, and she was fine. I guess it was about a week after that, we were kind of like inseparable. It was pretty wild. We got married a year later. We decided to get married. Lisa was very attractive, very outgoing, do anything for anybody. She was just unbelievable person. She was just, I never found a fault in her, you know? She was a great person. Lisa loved horses, would do anything. She could do anything. Some of the worst horses I've had that were real rough houses, she just got along with them. She could have a horse eat right out of her hand in a couple of days, you know? She could really change a horse. A lot of people always used to say, "What? I don't know what she sees in you, Timmy." It's hard to meet somebody like that, you know? Think the same, do the same, you know what I mean? Have the same ideas. Lisa and I were in business together with the race horses, man and wife team. I hauled horses up throughout the country. She more or less did the training when I was out of town. Lisa wanted to keep every horse that I bought. You had to buy them, you had to sell them, you couldn't get attached to them. I've had probably 400 or 500 horses been bought and sold. I used to have to take my horses to other farms and never let her see the ones that I would buy because she wanted to keep them all. We were married we were married 10 years. We were in Columbus, Ohio at Beulah Park Racetrack, and she got a real bad pain in her back. She had expressions on her face that I've never seen before, and I knew it was serious. And I just told her, look, Lisa, we're going home tonight. She had cancer. It's a miserable disease, I'll tell you. Late stages when she was sick, towards the end, she used to always comfort her mother and me that she would, don't worry, that she was gonna be back. And she was coming back as a horse. It's kind of crazy how all this happened, but she said, I'm gonna be back. I'm coming back as a horse. I'll be back. After my wife passed away, I sold all my horses. I traveled the whole country. I was kind of like, kind of lost, you know? I don't know if I was running from it or whatever. And then I eventually went back to Finger Lakes. I had it in the back of my mind to buy a horse and get back into training again. I got a phone call from a guy that I hadn't talked to in 4 years. He said, geez, I think I got a horse here you might be interested in. I had a couple $1,000 in my boot, and off I went in my station wagon, and I went to see the horse. I was like, wow. She had a problem with her foot, and she had one eye. She wasn't named. She never beat a horse in her life. Never had finished a workout in front of one or galloped in front of one. That's why they sold her. And then she had the one eye, and then she had the club foot. And she had a lot of faults against her, and they totally gave up on her. And I told them, I said, look, I got $2,000 in my boot. I'll give you $2,000 now and $2,500 when she wins. If she wins, you get paid. If she don't, she don't. Actually, how Lisa got her name, or Lisa's booby trap got her name, I was in my boss, the guy I was working for, John, said, he said, let's go to the booby trap. I said, all right, what is it? He said, oh, it's a gentleman's club. You get a nice big sandwich, you get a lunch, and you throw the girls a few bucks, and that's how she got her name. I named it after Lisa, and I named it after the bar, Lisa's booby trap. She went right in training. I had to make some changes with her. Her feet need some corrective shoeing. I trained her every day, exercised her every day. I galloped her myself. It took some time for her to develop into what she turned out to be. Different things struck me about her, you know. The look she would give me, and it sounds kind of, you know, everybody says about reincarnation and all that. It's kind of crazy. But this horse would actually, I could think something and she would do it. That's kind of the relationship we had, you know. And then Lisa, my wife, was the same way, you know. I could be thinking something and she knew what I was thinking. It was really, really crazy. But a lot of people picked up on it. I mean, she's like being Lisa. I want to know the truth. It's like being, and Lisa's still here, actually. Lisa never let nothing ever get her down, my wife. And Lisa, the horse, overcome. She had one eye and she was handicapped, couldn't see, but it didn't bother her. She would set pain aside to do her job, you know? And it takes quite a horse to do that. The first time I ever raced her, I drove by the cemetery on the way in and stopped and seen Lisa, and I told Lisa, I said, we're gonna win one today. This horse was just like out of her mind, feeling good, you know what I mean?
And there they go.
They said go, and she went right to the front.
Out for the lead race is Lisa's booby trap from the outside.
Every stride was, she opened up.
Lisa's booby trap getting away. Sandy.
She was a racehorse. No doubt about it.
And Lisa's booby trap has a big lead. She's all alone. Sandy Castle's in the second. Check out this debuter, Lisa's booby trap. Very impressive in her first look. She is an authoritative winner.
She went by 17 lengths, almost an eighth of a mile. There wasn't a horse in the picture. It was amazing. It was a real rush, a real thrill, you know. The purse was probably about $20,000. She won her first three races at Finger Lakes. It's called Finger Lakes Racetrack. and then Saratoga opened up, and the purses at Saratoga are $100,000, and at Finger Lakes they're $20,000. That's the difference. I was looking at a Saratoga book one day, and I said to myself, I said, well, I think she's earned her way to go to Saratoga. I think the odds started out at 10 to 1 at Saratoga. The four horses that was in the race with me, they spent $1 million on. I spent $4,500.
The horses have reached the starting gate. And they're off. Zermatt, Stroman, and
she was last from the start, from the beginning.
At Lisa's Booby Trap is the last of five.
So yeah, it was a real, very fast race, a lot of speed.
Our turn. Here's Lisa's Booby Trap, who's on the march. Fourth on the far outside. And Funny Feeling is fifth.
And she just kind of circled around him, and he hit her two or three times, and she just took off and ran right on by them like they were tied to the fence.
Lisa's Booby Trap has made a run from last onto the lead. And
they were all out. They'd ran hard all the way.
Here's Lisa's Booby Trap under the wire by a half a dozen lengths.
I had to fight my way through the crowd to get to the winner's circle. I'll tell you, I couldn't go to the donut shop without have a cup of coffee. They'd say, hey, that's the trainer at Lisa's Booby Trap, you know. Every lady that named Lisa, or every lady that had cancer, or anybody that had one eye, they were at my barn to meet Lisa's Booby Trap. I've had people in my, I had to have a guard to guard my horse. The horse was just fantastic with the camera. She loved people. She'd nuzzle up to people. She didn't bite or nothing. She'd love you up. When I got to Finger Lakes, the first guy came up to me, offered me $60,000. Then I had another guy offer me $250,000 in cash. Then I had a guy come from, was from Kentucky, that he offered me $500,000 for the horse. Broke as I was, I probably could have used $500,000. Money is dirty as far as I'm concerned. I didn't want to sell the horse, period. I don't think I'd sleep right at night if I sold her, you know? She was the star of Saratoga that year, and I mean, she didn't win $1 million race or nothing, but she was Horse of the Year. She was three-year-old Filly of the Year. She was Best Allowance Horse, male and female, of the year at Finger Lakes. I was working her. Just one day, I just got a feeling that it's not the right thing to do. I backed up, and I took her home. I took her home and retired her. I didn't want her to be crippled. See, a lot of horses can break down. People get greedy, and they want more, you know what I mean? And they push them right to the end. I've done it with a lot of horses, push them, you know, right on through. But I didn't want to do that with her, and this is the only horse in my whole career that I haven't sold. Everybody said, well, what the hell, why would you not want to run her? And I said, well, what if she broke her leg? It was a tough call. There was plenty of races for her. I could have run her 9 months of the year. I quit while I was ahead, and she was ahead of the game, you know? She's out in my barn. I see her every day. I brush her every day. I pick her feet every day. I feed her every day. I get an inkling or something in my stomach tells me, go to the barn. I go to the barn. I sleep a lot better at night. She's the biggest thing in my life right now. I don't know if that sounds a little strange, but it's about the biggest thing in my life. I love her to death. Yep, I certainly do. I get two Lisas, you know.
And you want to know the best part? When we talked to Tim, Lisa's Booby Trap was being bred to the Kentucky Derby winner, Big Brown. So stay tuned to hear about Lisa's little Booby Trap coming into the world. Ha! Big thanks for sharing your story, Tim Snyder. You can find out more in Tim's book, The Ghost Horse. We'll have a link on our site, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Anna Sussman, with sound design by Renzo Gorio. When Snap Judgment returns, someone puts everything on the line without thinking it through. When Snap Judgment, the No Perfect Love episode continues, stay tuned.
Those eyes, spend all your eyes with me.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, the No Perfect Love episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and now there are a lot of you out there right now, even now, that remain skeptical, dubious of this love at first sight notion. Okay. Have a listen to our next story before you put any money on it. Snap Judgment.
I was walking down a street and a girl was driving past in a car and our eyes met.
He seemed to almost have an aura about him that I found very attractive. He also looked like he was in need of a lift, but I did think that was slightly insane, so I kept driving.
And she kept driving, and I was back in my own head again.
But then I did actually hear a voice, and this is where it gets a bit supernatural. I'd never heard a voice before, and the voice was as clear as someone sitting next to me, and it said, "If you don't stop and pick this guy up, you'll regret it."
And that car got to a roundabout, and suddenly did a U-turn. This girl pulls up. She's got very wild hair, is what I noticed first. Big smile, very open smile. And she pulls up and throws open the passenger door.
I was nervous, but it was a real cocktail of nerves and absolutely high as a kite.
And before I knew what was happening, she's asking if I wanted to jump in and could she give me a lift.
It was probably less than 5 minutes. And in that time, we established that we actually had a mutual friend who he was studying with.
Toby rang that friend quite soon after our meeting.
And I can almost remember this word for word. I said, "I met this guy. His name's Dan. I don't know his surname. He's fantastic. I think I could be in a relationship with him," is what I said, which is insane.
The fact that Toby and I had just had this little interaction that was so unique, I suppose, felt quite promising. Apart from our meeting and starting that relationship, which seemed quite quick, getting engaged was a longer process. To be honest, it was really Toby taking the lead for many years, trying to kind of encourage me.
I felt confident that I wanted to formalize what we had already. So I started leaving notes on our shopping list.
And I'd get down past the yogurt and toilet paper and cauliflower, and there would be engagement ring, you know, in the same sort of scrawled text.
For a long time, I would also propose to Daniel, and I would always do it when it felt right for me to ask him. You know, a beautiful moment in your relationship, you might be going for a walk or you've seen a beautiful film or been out for dinner and you're just feeling right together. And then I would say, "Will you marry me?" And he would say, I can't just say yes to that. I want to see you putting in more effort.
I maybe didn't take it as a grave kind of proposal from her. It was more just a very kind of playful. We were still both young.
So that was my way of expressing my love and telling him I wanted to marry him, was just to say it when it felt right. But for him, as it turned out, it needed to be formalized and quite beautiful and theatrical.
My strategy was to take Toby totally by surprise. I'd ordered a large box full of these waterproof LED lights. And they arrived from the States, and I had to quite quickly hide them somewhere in the apartment so the game wouldn't be discovered.
And maybe it said this on the parcel, perhaps they specialised in underwater LEDs.
The whole thing had to be really casual in order for the surprise to sort of come off. So I caught the bus down to the bay, had been down there recently to check where the sun is at that particular time of day to make sure the effect would be heightened.
And he said to me, meet me at Gordon's Bay, which is the beach further south from us. And I thought, well, that's unusual. And I put two and two together. This Thursday evening, he's going to propose to me. And I thought, this just feels really odd.
I decided to create a star constellation out of these little LEDs. Had a bottle of champagne and some ice. And I set that up in a rock pool.
And he joined the stars so that it said, marry me, in the stars, as if to say our love is meant to be and it's in the stars.
So when I did show her the lights and then pull out this little star map and hand it to her, and
my heart felt heavy. It looked so vulnerable with the little lights illuminating the rock pool and the champagne. And I remember thinking, this isn't right for me. This moment isn't right. And we hugged, and he was waiting. He was looking at my face in anticipation. And I said, I'm really sorry. I said to him, I'm not saying no. I just can't say yes.
You go out on a limb like that, where even though it's someone you know so well, it really is very exposing to say, would you spend the rest of your life with me? And when someone doesn't necessarily say no, but certainly doesn't say yes, I needed to know what was going on.
And he said, well, will you come to the restaurant with me anyway? And I said, no, I really can't. I'm so sorry.
I had a limousine driver waiting in a car just above the rocks. I had booked a boutique hotel for the night as well.
And then I walked home and he was left, and he had to go and tell the driver that it wouldn't be needed.
I think I was pretty dazed. Eventually did come back to the apartment. And at that stage, I was certainly a bit of a wreck. I was sobbing uncontrollably, and I remember just collapsing on a bench outdoor on the balcony.
To see my partner bereft like that was horrible.
And it wasn't just an emotional thing. It quite quickly became quite a physiological thing where my body just was sapped of all energy from that emotional kind of disappointment.
Very quickly the next day, it was obvious to me that he was also unwell.
I started to develop what was strangely a pain in my spine. Every step I took would lead to a sharp shooting pain, and this headache that I had kind of didn't fade at all. It really just was set in.
It's like his whole body became stiff with age all of a sudden.
And we went to the local GP. She said, well, I hate to say it, but I think you've got some sort of meningitis. It's really serious, and you've got to get yourself to emergency because you can be dead in a matter of, 48 hours. So here I was with my not bride-to-be, and she drove me off to emergency. after many, many hours in the waiting room, they did all agree that I had viral meningitis.
When we came home from hospital, I became Daniel's primary carer, and I cared for him for close to a week, and we just shut ourselves away from the world. It was as though we had to put all of the emotional trauma to the side.
I think Toby was really keeping her distance. She was certainly looking after me, but was not engaging in any meaningful kind of discussions or interaction at the time. It was really just a nursing role without wanting to bring to the fore that complicated, awkward problem that we had before us.
And in that time, I also did a lot of soul searching. I went for long walks and I tried to piece together whether or not I wanted to marry Daniel. It really felt like all or nothing. I took some of those LED, underwater LED candles that Daniel had used at the proposal.
She had taken those lights, switched them all on that same balcony, and written three large letters, YES. And she had a very gentle smile on her face where she almost wasn't expecting me to accept it.
And he wept. And within 24 hours, he had recovered from his viral meningitis. And that was us. That felt right.
Love, sweet love. Thank you, Toby and Dan, for sharing your story. That piece, it came to us from independent producer Kate Montague. She produced a different version for the storytelling platform Narratively. We'll have a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. That piece was produced by Kate Montague with assistance from Anna Adlerstein. Right, you've reached the end of this hour of Snap Judgment, sure, but not to fear. A whole world of Snap awaits your listening pleasure. Subscribe now to the podcast for hours of Snap storytelling for free. iTunes, Stitcher, wherever amazing things are collected and handed out for free. snapjudgment.org. Join the conversation on Facebook, Snap Judgment, Twitter, Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and a team that knows only perfect love. He's the Barry White of public media, the Uber producer, Mark Ristich. Pat Mesiti-Miller has to beat him off with a stick. Anna Sussman, she says how it's going to be. Julia DeWitt makes grown men weep. Renzo Gorio makes grown men weep. Joe Rosenberg's perfect partner is flipping through the pages of a New Yorker even as I write this. David Kim, he's happy for now. Nancy Lopez is on fire. The amazing Snap Judgment, Get Her Done crew, Anna Adlerstein, Eliza Smith, Leon Morimoto, and Aurora Soria. Jasmine Aguilera is laughing at something, but she won't tell you what. Have you ever gone in search of true love's kiss? Well, better not to wander around the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm not sure they appreciated what we were trying to do. But much love to the CPB. Tell PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, that if they like it, They should have put a ring on it. PRX.org. And this is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could ask one of those cool mariachi bands to play a tune for your girlfriend. And when they leave, you could notice your girlfriend is gone too. And you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR. No.